Congratulations, Michelle Fields. I'm really proud of her because I know Michelle.
Okay, everybody, can I ask you to take your seat? We're going to start.
Emily Wong, Mercedes Smith, Alethea Simon, Curtis Stevens.
Okay. We want to start on time so we can all get to lunch on time.
That's right, lunch.
Very important. So as I promised, this is our last panel before lunch, but because we don't want you to go to sleep, we wanted to save some of the most interesting stuff and most provocative stuff for our pre-lunch panel, and it's a really great one. If you look at the title of it, it's After the Inmates Go Home, as most of them do. And we have some superb folks to really lead us off on it. We're going to go for an hour and a half again, and then till 1 o'clock, and then we'll break for lunch. And to lead us off on this panel, as our moderator, we're really, really pleased to have Curtis Stephen, who again, like a lot of our moderators, works both ends of the street, except his end of the street is also as an assistant professor of journalism at Long Island University's Brooklyn campus, which is his alma mater as well. And Curtis is a veteran journalist. He's been around for quite a while, running stories on a bunch of issues. He's worked for Newsweek, Newsday, City Limits, AM New York, and he started out as a CNN reporter. So, Curtis, I'm going to hand it over to you, and we'll start right away.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that wonderful introduction of me. I'm just amazed that that all happened. But honored to be here this morning with all of you, and let's crunch some numbers very briefly, right? We know that 1.5 million, as of at last standing, are the number of people who are incarcerated. And I went to the main website this morning, of course, for those signing up for healthcare, and I was able to get on it, by the way. There were no glitches, but we see three things on there, right, in terms of eligibility. One, that you must be a U.S. citizen, right? Two, that you must be living in the United States. And the third is that you can't be incarcerated, right? But we also know the recidivism rates. We also know that eventually, as the title of this panel tells us, that many folks will be coming home inevitably. And we do have an all-star panel this morning to look at what the implications, of course, of the healthcare law is for them. So, just to my immediate right, we have Dr. Alethea Simon, who's the Vice President of Programs and Policy at New York City's Green Hope Services for Women. She works, of course, a lot with women who are formerly incarcerated. She also sits for Green Hope on Governor Cuomo's Work for Success Employment Initiative for the formerly incarcerated, and co-chairs the Manhattan Recovery Community Coalition. Also to her right, we have Mercedes Smith, who is the outreach policy specialist at Women on the Rise, telling her story, and she has quite a story indeed for folks who are not aware. She had been formerly incarcerated, and where she also served was at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in upstate New York. She emerged as a leader there, a coordinator of the teen preteen overnight program, as well as she obtained her HIV peer education and counseling certificate. And of course, more online, but more in your pamphlet, of course. But she also produced a documentary, Removing the Stigma of Incarceration. And finally, to her right, Dr. Emily Wang, who is an assistant professor of general medicine at Yale School of Medicine. She's trained former prisoners to become community health workers and really is engaged on this question of health and those who were formerly incarcerated. And again, more here. So we're just going to start with 5 minutes each for folks to just sort of lay out the lay of the land in terms of what we're looking at here for people who are formerly incarcerated and how this law impacts them. Dr. Simon?
Good afternoon. So our work with, we work for, predominantly with women who are in our program as an alternative to incarceration. So instead of going to prison, they come to our program for anywhere from 6 months to 18 months. It depends on the discretion of the court. And then we have women who are on parole, and they're there for 4 months. We have a contract with the Department of Parole, and we work with parole officers, probation officers, and so forth. And we do have women that are in our program that do not have a criminal justice background. We actually work with the women from there in prison to the time that they are in reentry, and then also after reentry. We have a residential program, and we offer also an outpatient services program. That's where the woman lives in the community, and she comes to us Monday through Friday for services, and then in the afternoon as well. We offer child care services on site. We're able to do integrative health services. For us, that includes yoga, Reiki, massage therapy. We do acupuncture, acupressure. We do believe in a holistic treatment for women, and that women should be able to, or actually anyone who are formerly incarcerated and have a substance abuse problem, to be able to access services that are not only traditional medical services. I should have said that our program is primarily a substance abuse program. So everyone that comes to our agency, all the women have a substance abuse issue. We also have women who are mothers who have their children on site, so they're with us, again, anywhere from 6 months to 18 months. We have 28 women and 28 children between the ages of 0 to 5, and we provide on-site services for them. Some of the medical issues that come that the women come with are, generally, we see women who have gynecological issues. We also have... recently, we've actually had more women in the last year that come to us with cancer. They were diagnosed while they were incarcerated or were diagnosed previously, but because of their drug use did not address the issue. So they're in treatment now, and that's when we find that they're addressing the issue. So we've seen a significant increase than normal. We have women who have HIV, Hep C. Those are common disorders that we see on site. And then we've also had an increase of women who are visually impaired that are in our program. And they're newly blind women who found out while they were incarcerated that something was wrong with their eyes or whatever the situation is, got assistance, and then get assistance from us. Psychiatric issues are significant within our population. 85% of our women have some sort of psychiatric disorder. This is a significant increase from doing this now for 18 years. In 1994, I didn't see this many women with psychiatric stress disorder, and there's also, which is a very common, major depressive, and bipolar is another one that's a predominant. We do have some clients with schizoaffective disorders that are in our program, but they have to be well medicated. I think coming into treatment, one of the biggest issues is the women come and they don't have medication. And not having medication, or they're sent to us from Rikers Island, and they may have 30 days. But this is what they say when they're released. But then they get there, and it's about a week's worth of medication. So you, as the organization, have to figure out, if this woman does not have Medicaid, how do you then treat this person? We have a psychiatrist that work with us on a weekly basis. However, what happens is we have to figure out how to pay for this medication, because, of course, you know, medication is very cheap. So we have a pharmacy that we work with now that is able to give us, as we call it, the medication up front, so that the woman can then, when her Medicaid, or if she gets Medicaid, is approved for Medicaid, I should say, then she's able to pay for that. So, psychiatric issues and medical issues are significant for the women when they come into our program. And what we try to do, we have on-site healthcare services, and we work with community health clinics to really give them the services that they need. The great thing about the new program is that Affordable Care Act is that Medicaid will be expanded. And so some of the criteria that may have hindered women from Medicaid or even just general insurance, for example, like domestic violence. Insurance may not say up front that domestic violence is something that they are, that's an issue. But what happens is it can be considered as, they can look at it as a historical nature, of a historical nature. And so if you were abused, this might be considered a pre-existing condition. And so then women will not be able to get the services that they need. So that has been an issue also. So that's the wonderful thing about ACA. Now that's not an issue. You cannot discriminate based on some of these things. You cannot write that into your current policy. And we do have some women that are on general insurance plans, whether it's through their parents because they're under 26, or they have been working but they're leave from their jobs and so forth. These are more our outpatient clients. So those are the different things that we've experienced, I think. And just to wrap up, it is a difficult fight to at times for to address the medical issues that the women come to us with. It's significant. And to be able to have funding for it is a blessing. And the only way that we do that significantly is through Medicaid. And Medicaid helps our women and it helps our staff to be able to meet the general needs of the clients. But also it's through the work of clinics who will see our clients for free. Medicaid takes about 45 days sometimes for a woman to get on. And to be able to have clinics that provide us free services. Now, this is not always the case, but to be able to do that so that you can care for a woman that comes into your agency with cancer is significant for us. So I believe that the new health insurance will significantly help to improve women when they come out of prison, not necessarily when they're incarcerated.
Good afternoon. So let me tell you my story. I came home from prison after doing 20 years. Once released from prison June 2010, I was able to get Medicaid. Of course, I came home wanting to get a job and be a productive person in society. I get a part-time job and immediately I'm cut off of Medicaid. I'm not told anything. I'm not given a heads up. I'm just cut off of Medicaid. I have atopic dermatitis, which is a skin disease that needs constant care. I have to make a choice. Do I take care of my skin or do I not take care of my skin and do I pay my bills? But as a productive citizen in society, I choose to pay my bills. So my skin goes away. No, I can't take care of it, not unless it gets bad enough that I have to make a choice to go to the emergency room. I go to the emergency room and what do? I get a bill that's impossible for me to pay off of my salary because I work a part-time. I work two part-time jobs that does not allow me to get health insurance at all. So I don't make enough to pay for insurance, but I don't qualify to get Medicaid any longer. So what do? I go without insurance. Because I did 20 years in prison, yes, I can suffer from PTSD. And it may not appear immediately, but later on when it does appear, I don't have any insurance to go to the doctor to seek help for whatever is ailing me or for whatever is bothering me mentally. It may be my incarceration. It may be my transition back into society. It do play a big part, but if I have no medical insurance to help me go to the doctor to seek help for my condition, that leaves me out there alone with no help. When you come home from prison, you come home. When I was in prison, I did get care from the doctors on a regular basis. I wouldn't say that it was the best care in the world because it wasn't. But I did get care from a doctor upon entering into society. Now I cannot get care from a doctor. Or either there are the choices where I go to free clinics, but I don't get to see specialty doctors. I don't get to have a mammogram. I don't get to get my eyes tested. I don't get to go to the dentist, not unless I pay for it. Or for my salary, I can't afford to pay for it. I went to Medicaid. I had a conversation with them about, you know, you're looking at the gross of my pay. You're looking at what I make before they take out taxes. Once they take out taxes, I'm unable to pay for insurance. Why can't, even if you give me a partial payment plan and allow me to pay a little bit, it can help me to get the help that I need upon coming home. But they told me no, they couldn't do it. They told me absolutely not to get insurance. They didn't give me a certificate to say, because there is a certificate where lets you segue out of Medicaid into insurance. I didn't even qualify for the certificate. Before I can even get on Medicaid, they made me go through a substance abuse to make sure I didn't need a drug treatment program. And I'm saying, I don't need a drug treatment program. I just need a Medicaid card so I can go to the doctor and get treated. Upon coming home from prison, in prison they put you on 20 to 30 different pills. When you come home, they're a combination of medications that can cut down how many pills that you take. So, yeah, you do want to see a doctor. And it doesn't happen, because usually what happens with the doctors is they have to do their own check into your care, check you over, run the different tests. They're not going to follow the tests that was issued to you while you was in prison. So in the meantime, while these tests are going on, you're cut off of Medicaid. Because you do get Medicaid as soon as you get home. The city do give you Medicaid. But as soon as you find employment, they cut you off for it. So you're left without any services. For the last, I've been home almost 4 years, and I've been without insurance for 3 of those years. So I go to the doctor. I have to pick and choose when I go to the doctor. If I'm really, really sick, I have to go to the emergency room. And I have to take the little money that I have to pay for my medication. Other than that, what was the purpose of going to the emergency room? I could have stayed sick. I've worked with women who have came home from prison with mental health issues. Just like was said just a little while ago, they say they give you 30 days, but they only give you 7 days worth of medication when you come home. So these women that have mental health issues, they're walking out of the prisons. They're taking the 7 days worth of medication, and if they're not housed in a mental health environment, they're not given no more medication. So it leaves these people out in the city of New York without any medications in their system that allows them to not make proper decisions that allow them to go back to prison, which is unfair to them because they're coming out in a helpless situation where Medicaid should automatically be given to them so that they can continue their treatment. Because it was because of some of the treatment that they received inside that allowed you to release them from prison, but then you put them back out on the streets and you don't give them medication, so you put them back in the same situation that they was in prior to going to prison. No medication, nothing to balance them out. I've spoken with women who've came home and found out they had cancer. And they died because they didn't have Medicaid. I had a really good friend that had hepatitis C. And because she had no medical coverage, she died. She couldn't get the services that she needed. So those are the issues that's around me and all my sisters that's coming home and my brothers that's coming home from prison. They're not getting the proper medical insurance that they need. Medicaid is not being responsible to say, we know you just came out of prison. We're going to allow you to get on your feet. We're going to help get you through this little process, this little period of time. Until you get there, there's no way that a person that did 20 years in prison come home and after a year you take them off of Medicaid and you think that all their insurance, everything should be taken care of. It doesn't happen like that. To this day, I still can't get on the website to even apply. I'm still having an issue, so I'm still without medical coverage. I pay right now to go to the doctor. I pay to get my medication, and I pick and choose what's serious enough. My biggest fear is that when I do get insurance, that I'm going to have something wrong with me, that it's going to be too late for the doctors to fix. Order to give me surgery to remove, and I could die because of this reason. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wayne.
Good afternoon. Sorry I was late, and it's a real privilege to be here today on this panel. One of the things I think, I think I might start too with a narrative, which is, hearing Mercedes talk about her story and Dr. Simon, I think that it's more than clear that there are real injustices, and, as a physician, as the primary... Good.
That was helpful.
All right, so nothing to worry about there. So as a primary care physician, I think one of the real things that strikes me are the vast inefficiencies in the system. And I think about the story that Mercedes told and about some of the hundreds and thousands of patients I've now seen returning home from prison. And I think when I first started in this path, the truth of it is that individuals are constitutionally guaranteed health care when in prison. And up until 2014, it's the only place where there was a constitutional guarantee for a sort of primary medical care. What this means is about 40% of individuals first access health care when they're incarcerated. 40% of individuals are diagnosed with a chronic medical condition when they're inside, and when they're released, often don't have access to health care. And so in 2006, as a resident then working in San Francisco, these sorts of inefficiencies just drove me nuts. I think about kind of the work that we try to do on the outside, thinking about bridging the health and really improving the health of individuals when they're at home in a community health center. And the fact that people could get health care when inside and couldn't when they're out just struck me as inconceivable. And so in 2006, and I think you might have heard from Dr. Redmond earlier, we started Transitions Clinic, which was an endeavor where we first wanted to think about how to improve those transitions in care between prison healthcare system and the community healthcare system, organized focus groups among returning prisoners, among healthcare providers that had been incarcerated, among prisoners, as well as among local community agencies, and came up with four what we saw principles in organizing, better organizing the healthcare at this transition point. And what it involved was immediate and early access to care within 2 weeks. You know, frankly, the folks that we asked said days, but we settled on 2 weeks following release from prison. The second thing they wanted is a physician that knew they'd been incarcerated. So a space where it was safe to talk about having been in prison, a space where the physician knew that they had been incarcerated, that there are additional risks to being incarcerated, additional risks perhaps of having a post-traumatic stress disorder. They wanted a community health worker that had a past history of incarceration to help them navigate, which is what seems to me an endless maze of health services and social service agencies that individuals must navigate following release. And they wanted that community health worker to be formally incarcerated, someone that had walked in their shoes before, someone that knew what it felt like, and someone that could be that person that helps navigate them through the social service system as well as help manage their chronic medical conditions. And the fourth is they wanted strong partnerships with agencies like Dr. Simon. So they wanted organizations in the community that were already taking care of individual social determinants of health, their housing, their employment, their reunification with their family, their legal services. And that to them were the kind of four basic concepts of a Transitions Clinic program. And so it's with that that we started in San Francisco, hired a former prisoner, which wasn't an easy thing to do, to start working in the healthcare system. Studied it using a randomized control trial, found that individuals that, and I can talk more about the details about this, but the bottom line is that when comparing those that had been seen and followed in care in Transitions Clinic versus those that had gotten immediate access in the safety net system within 2 weeks of release in that other arm, those that stayed in Transitions in the model that I described had about a 50% fewer emergency department visits in the subsequent 12 months. And so it's with that and with those data that we have been able to start coalescing a network of community health centers across the country that are interested in designing models that are led by former prisoners as well as physicians that are already or already have experience working with former prisoners or those that are incarcerated, and community health centers that are all situated in communities with high rates of incarceration. in 2010 with funding from the Langeloth Foundation, and now with funding from the Healthcare Innovation Awards of the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services. We now have worked closely with 20 community health centers across the country, 10 of which are being funded by CMS explicitly to study how, if you hire a person with a history of incarceration and they're working within a community health center, how does that change the experience of health, healthcare utilization, and ultimately cost? And so when I think about the Affordable Care Act, and I think that clearly I would suspect that there, it holds so much promise, about 30 to 65% are the estimates of newly returning individuals from a correctional facility will newly be eligible for Medicaid. It's clear that obviously having insurance is the first step, but I would just caution this, is that it's the first step that we know from Massachusetts experience that just because everyone's insured doesn't mean you have access to primary care. In fact, the emergency department utilizations in the large cities of Massachusetts have gone up. Secondly, what we know is just because you have insurance doesn't mean you want to go to a primary care doctor. Doesn't mean that you won't feel discriminated in the healthcare setting, and doesn't mean that you'll feel safe in the healthcare experience talking to your physicians and your providers about the very issues that will impact your health. And so I think that while the Affordable Care Act offers promise, it's important to kind of understand the complexity of it. It's a really exciting time, certainly for all of those in us in the network, and in particular thinking about our patients, but I think that that's the first piece. The second is this, is that many of you may know is that CMS just passed a rule in July saying that now state Medicaid programs can bill for community health workers for their activities in preventing, basically in preventive services and those that can't be billed for within the healthcare setting. And so this offers, again, I think in our network and thinking about former prisoners as they may be employed as community health workers working in these healthcare settings, a real opportunity to think about the role of former prisoners in transforming primary care.
Thank you, Dr. Wang, and thanks to all three of you for laying the land for what we face. So we have 40-some-odd minutes to play with, and I really want your questions to sort of dominate here because it's important for that to be the case. But let me just throw this out there, and I'm thinking really and listening to you, Mercedes, and if I'm not mistaken, you were released in 2010? Is
yes.
that when you came home?
Yes.
And really, listening to her story, right, we get the sense of someone who, like so many folks who come out of prison, are essentially alone, although you're dealing with issues of family reunification, and one gets the sense of reorienting yourself in society. With that as a reality, who's sort of helping, right? And I want to turn to the providers as well, because if you're leaving prison, you get home and you're dealing with that, you don't know what you don't know, right? In terms of what the services are, and you came out in 2010. Look what happened in 2011 and 12 with this policy. So who is helping folks as they come out know what their access, you know, what sort of access that they have? Obviously, community collaboration is important, as Dr. Wang said, but who's actually the first point of contact to individuals?
Well, when you first come home, it's usually parole. Parole. You have to go to parole. You're mandated to report to parole as soon as you come home. But parole is not telling you about medical issues. Parole is not saying to you, here, this is how you fill out an application, and this is how you get a Medicaid so that you can go to the doctors and get help. That's your first point when you first come home. After that, usually you connect with community organizations, and it's at these community organizations where we work with the individual to help them to get to that place where they can fill out an application. Like if they go, like we refer a woman to Green Hope, Green Hope will work with her to get her Medicaid card, to get housing. Or if somebody refer a woman to us, we work with them and we refer them to somebody else to get the help that they need or the services that they need.
So is it a fair point then, Dr. Wang, Dr. Simon, respectively, that with respect to women as well, that if you were talking about going to specific organizations, that there's, let's say, a pool of, let's say, young Black and Hispanic men who are not then going to these community service organizations for various reasons and then are missing access to services?
Well, I think it depends. And I say that because when you're incarcerated, there are some availabilities to have organizations that are there that you could speak with. And so, for example, Osborne Association is one of those organizations that's in a lot of the men prisons. We're in some of the women's prisons that are closer to New York City, like Bedford Hills and Taconic the jail, Rikers Island. So clients, we refer to them as clients. That's how they get to know you. And so they see you around the prisons. They see you running groups because we don't just go to recruit clients. We provide groups, so different reentry topics that they may have, educational topics, career topics we discuss. Also, in Rikers Island alone, you have 20 programs that are in there. For various reasons, not just for substance abuse. So like Fortune Society does a lot of housing, so they're in, so people know about them. But the biggest resources are the inmates themselves. They really are the ones that's how a lot of women come to us, because of organizations like Worth, but they work with the inmates, and they tell women who we are. Even women that, unfortunately, they come through our program and they go back, they'll talk about our program, what they should have done, what they shouldn't have done. And they actually do the recommendations, and that's how we're getting clients. So I think that's how the resources are for men and women. There are, though, people who are incarcerated that hasn't taken those opportunities, don't go to those groups, and so they're not aware of how to get to some of these services. And we do have, I think it has improved with parole, some parole officers, I should say, that will give resources. And if the parolee is asking about where they should go, what they should do. The other thing that we've done now is gone to parole offices for parole visit days, where we can talk with the women about the different services that we provide. And it really is up to a lot of the organizations to make sure that we're out there. But the inmates, I think, are the biggest resources, and people who are formerly incarcerated.
I also want to say that I go into Queensboro Correctional Facility, and I do a support group with the men. And the question did come up about Medicaid recently. And the great thing about Queensboro is inside of Queensboro, they help them prepare for Medicaid. They fill out the application. So upon release, those men are receiving Medicaid, but the women that do a long sentence and they're being released, they're coming home and the applications have changed. Things have changed. First of all, society looks completely different. So they're intimidated just by walking down the street. So to give them an application to fill out is like, and as educated as I consider myself, I had a problem filling out the application. So the men, they are really lucky because they get the service inside of Queensboro. But those are the men in Queensboro. What happened to the men in Greenhaven and Fishkill, the women in Bedford, the women in Taconic, the women in Albion, the women in Rikers, I'm not even sure. But those women are coming home and they're going to parole. Parole is not helping them, and I agree with Dr. Simon, because what happened is that we do go to parole, and even though I'm still on parole, I do go to parole, and I speak to the men and the women inside different parole offices about the programs and the services that are being offered out here to help them. There are a number of free clinics that help the men and women when they first come home to apply for Medicaid if they're not receiving it, to give them those services that they need. But some of these women are traveling 2 and 3 hours getting to these clinics because it's so far out of the way that they're thinking, well, I might as well not even go. I don't even have the extra car fare to get there. So some don't even want to go to these clinics to receive the services.
Anything to add, Dr. Wang?
Sure. So just to, in response to your question of thinking about the men in particular that have returned home and whether or not there might be some that don't access resources, I mean, I think, you know, my response to that is it depends. And I would say certainly I think that there are settings across the country that are not nearly as resource rich as New York City. Given kind of our experience in New York City, it's definitely one, and even in New Haven, it's a real resource rich place in terms of the access to different programs, the different types of funding structures, the different types of services that might be offered. That said, even for our patients in New Haven, I would find that we often are siloed, that, you know, the services aren't interconnected, and that's a real kind of issue that our patients, in particular the men, are confronted when they return home, that they may get a certain set of recommendations and priorities from parole, another set of recommendations from their physician, another set of recommendations from their substance abuse providers that are court mandated that they have to go to, and then another set of kind of competing priorities are the ones that really drive them about employment, housing, and their family. And so I think many of them don't often access the services that we would like them to access. I don't think that they're really well prioritized, and so certainly there can be kind of more of a coordination of services where they exist. But many, many cities across the country, I think about, we've often had conversations about in the South, there are just fewer resources compared to those that may exist in New York.
Fair. And I invite anyone who has a question to just indicate, and we already have some hands, so let's go down the circle.
Tell us your name.
Thank you. Yannick Rice-Lamb from Howard University and thegrail.com in MSNBC. My question is for Ms. Smith. I have two questions. One is, what was the turning point? What made you get involved in helping other women and men with some of the things you went through? And then also, when you're making the decisions about which things to take care of health-wise, which ones do you choose, or what are some of the decisions you've had to make? I know you mentioned your skin.
Okay, so my what made me decide to help men and women is because I realized upon being released from prison that we usually cling to people who have been in the same situation as ourselves. And I've always been the type of person to reach out and help others from when I was in prison. So when I came home, I knew that was my passion, to continue to help men and women coming home from prison. Because where I was fortunate to have a great support system, some people are not as fortunate. So I lend myself out to be that support system to my sisters and brothers coming home, to help make their transition that much more easier. And what makes the decision about when I go to the doctor? Usually when my skin get really, really bad, or usually when I'm in a condition where I just can't get out the bed. But 9 times out of 10, I usually try to find home remedies. You know, internet is fabulous. You go on the internet, find a home remedy, see if it works. If it doesn't work, try something different. Then by then, I've waited. I had an issue recently, and I waited 3 weeks to go to the doctor for it because I just couldn't afford it at the time.
We saw more hands, too, I think, going the circle. Yes.
So I believe you said that your clients have a mix of coverage. Many are on Medicaid, but some have like private commercial insurance. Is that right?
Right. In mostly through their parents.
Right.
Oh, sorry.
And in general, when those clients need behavioral health and mental health services specifically, which of those two groups has easier access to decent care?
I would say, I guess because of the provider that we use, I would say both. The specialty care, though, for the insurance, the clients with the general insurance, and believe me, they're a tiny number, would be much better. And it's because also of the communities that some of these women are coming from. Give you an example. This year, we've seen many more clients from Nassau County than we've ever in our life. In the history of our programs, and that's increased dramatically.
It's outside of New York.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry. I make an assumption everybody's from New York. So we're seeing many.
It's also
more,
one of the top 10 richest counties in the country.
There you go. So these women are coming from Long Island, and so they have the resources, where they're able to get some of the assistance that they need that we may not be able to provide. And so they can go to those specialized treatment if they needed to. But more so, I think we work with an organization here in New York. I think they might be all over the country, though, the Institute for Family Health. And I really appreciate the work that we've been doing with this organization, because they are very much informed about criminal justice issues and about criminal health care needs. One of the things that really has helped us, and this is to go off topic a little bit, they have residents that are in our program now for 2-week rotations, where they really learn about substance abuse and they learn about healthcare needs of the women, and they get to understand the different groups that the women have to participate in, what are some of the criminal justice issues. I really think that an organization that's dedicated to having doctors who understand the population is an organization that I feel does well with our population. And so to be able to meet the care, what we've seen is a significant reduction in the amount of clients now that we've had to send to the emergency room. If they have an emergency, they go to the clinic, they get the needs met. So we've been able to decrease significantly those numbers. So I think because of that organization, and maybe for us it's unique, so I'll say that, we find that we're giving clients better health care than they need. But the persons that have the regular health care, I think with specialty care, it far exceeds what they get on Medicaid. And I say that because you don't have to wait 3-4 weeks to see a doctor if you have breast cancer. I have a client now that she's been in our organization, I think, for 4 months, and she's waiting on an appointment that's coming up at the end of the month, and she's been waiting for a month. That's ridiculous, and you have breast cancer. And so fortunately for us, we have a doctor, a physician that we work with on site, that's been able to help her and have her do certain things to assist her. But I think that definitely Medicaid needs significant improvement, let's just say.
If I could follow up just really quickly, I mean, my understanding is that, specifically on the mental health side, my understanding is that, you know, the people who are able to get mental health care in the United States are generally on Medicaid or have enough money that they can
Absolutely.
Buy those services themselves, because a lot of commercial insurance doesn't cover. So is it your experience that when someone has a mental health need and they have Medicaid, you're like, okay, they're going to get taken care of in a timely way, and if they have private insurance, maybe, maybe not?
Yeah. Yes, okay. Definitely.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Definitely.
I'm really happy that we have this conference formally pressured with the panels. Thank you to the organizers for doing that, because I've been to some of these other conferences where we don't really get that perspective. But I want to ask specifically of Mercedes and Emily, it sounds, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mercedes, it sounds like you trained yourself on how to help people. You wanted to help people. You didn't necessarily get training to do this bridging between the things that people needed and where they could find them medically. Is that right?
That is so right.
And I want to ask Emily about how that training goes on. You are training people to do that, and they're funded and getting paid for it. How are you finding them, and what exactly are they doing when they get trained?
So when we first started the program, we were working closely. We still do with the City College of San Francisco. It has a rich history and tradition, a program that trains community health workers as part of a healthcare delivery system. It's through partnering with them that we designed a four credit course on specifically training community health workers to work with a post-incarcerated population. And so that's embedded within the City College of San Francisco, really trying to embrace the notion that those that have a past history of incarceration are the best suited to really be a community health worker, someone that both does. I think there's a lot of terms for this position, but you know, things really about both the health services navigation, the social services navigation, but also teaching about chronic disease management. So our community health workers, they might meet a person prior to release from the prison system, or if they're not permitted inside immediately post-release, help them initially in the days, weeks, first try to address the most urgent needs. But ultimately, we, to give you an example, or many examples, we had a patient that was released without oxygen, needed an oxygen tank. We provided that. The clinic did, filled out the order. Without having the clinic notified of the patient, we wouldn't have been able to do so. And the community health worker then brought this oxygen tank to the SRO where the patient was going to be living. And this is in San Francisco. And so that's an example of how, you know, kind of immediate, urgent, chronic disease management is actualized by a community health worker. Another thing that our community health workers might do is a patient that has diabetes, for instance, that was diagnosed when in prison. It's an incredibly passive experience for those of you who have stepped, you guys all did, stepped foot into a prison or a jail. It's a pretty passive experience. You stick out your arm, you know, the nurse checks, she gives the insulin, moves along. And so many folks are released without any knowledge of how to manage their own chronic condition. Our community health worker then, after they see the patient and meet the patient in our clinic, will then follow up in the shelter system and make sure that they understood what it is that I said as the doctor. Did they get the numbers? Do they understand what the plan is? Do they even know how to pull up the Lantus, et cetera? So the insulin. So those sorts of the curriculum then is embedded within the City College of San Francisco. How we're training the national cadre of community health workers is on an online platform. This is something that we are trying. It's a, I think, been an it's in a pilot stage, which is that learning online, I think, is difficult for many individuals that have been formerly incarcerated. The teaching around the chronic disease management happens on site, on the job. So the teaching that happens for the community health worker that works in our clinic is with me pulling up the insulin where he's learning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks. Since your organizations are based in New York City, I'm sure you have a lot of contact with Latina and the education system. I would like to know what is their major issue for Latina after going to be transition for their major concern?
Well, I don't think that anybody's issue is any more greater than the next person. I think that as formerly incarcerated, we all come out with the same issues. I don't think because she's Latino or he's Latino, his issue is any different. We all need the same services and we all need the same help. Now, what may be wrong with you may be a little different, but I think the services that we need is the same. Well, inside, one of the things that happens inside.
No, go ahead.
One of the things that happens inside is that women live under the umbrella of what happened with men in their prisons. So if at a male prison they do something, to like hurt a doctor, it falls down and the women have to suffer because the men may have did something. But as far as when we come home, you know, men, women, we're the ones that tell our men, you need to go to the doctor, you need to get a checkup. 9 times out of 10, men do not go to the doctor, not unless they have a stomach ache or they just in pain that they is unbearable. With women, we walk around with this pain for weeks, and we are able to take care of the family, to go to work, to come home. So that's where I think the issues may be different, opposes men than women. With women, we're caretakers. This is what we do. Men, they need to be babied a little bit, so they need to go to the doctor to make sure they're not dying.
So to answer your question first, and then I'll also address your question, the issues for Latina women and other women in our program are very similar in the sense of the substance abuse, the mental health, and so forth. But I think what may differ is what the concentration sometimes and the issues are. I think that we see a lot of Latina women who will have a definite focus on relationships and family. That's very significant. And sometimes it's really counseling that person to be selfish in a way about you first and not be so just always thinking about the family and putting that family member first. That's something that we see significantly with that population. And we have a group that we talk about being self-centered and that it's okay for a woman to be self-centered while you're in this treatment process. And that being self-centered doesn't mean that you forget about other people. It means that you're taking care of yourself. And that self-centeredness is not about negativity. It's about being positive and talking about who you are and knowing that you cannot take care of John or Sally or whoever it is before you take care of yourself. So I think family issues is something that we see significantly in the population. And then also some of the things that we do differently is making sure that we have staff members that are able to meet the needs of the population in the sense of speaking the language, having groups, because we have clients that when we do a client satisfaction survey, those are some of the things that will come up where, you know, I don't have a counselor that I could speak Spanish with because some of the things that I say is very different. When I say it in Spanish, I feel it differently. And, you know, it's even as simple as I'm West Indian. And then when I want to say certain things to my mother, I switch to Patois because it makes more sense to me. And she gets what I'm trying to say to her. So it's that it's not as rich as speaking Spanish, but it really is something that the population has taught us about over the years. And that makes it really different and makes a more enriching program for the women. There are definitely different issues between men and women. You see the different treatments in the prisons. There are much more services. Now they've reduced significantly, but there are many more services for men in male prisons than there are in women prisons. Most definitely. Also, some of the issues that women are dealing with that men deal with also but may come out more for women are issues of trauma, domestic violence, child abuse, molestation. These are things that are prominent, that are in front for women, even if we don't want to deal with them. We also have to deal with the family members. When we come home, it's not only about ourselves. It's about everything else that we also have to take care of. And, you know, on Mother's Day, there are more people visiting men than there are visiting women. Why? Because the women are visiting men. Mothers are not visiting their daughters on Mother's Day. And it's a sad situation, but if you talk to a lot of prisoners, this is what you'll hear, that on Mother's Day, the visits are not as much because it's harder to get men to take the children to prison than it is for a woman to take their children to the prison to visit their mom. So there are some dynamics that are significant, and it's just the way the system is set up at times. And so what we try to do is to combat those issues when they get into our system and to really work with them while they're incarcerated.
More hands. Sorry, yours first, and you. Yeah.
I'm hearing a little bit about the potential for the ACA within the criminal justice system and transitioning back into the community, but a little bit about even if we provide the availability of these services, the devil in the detail is really getting somebody to care enough about themselves to get to healthcare or take a 2-hour bus ride. Are there any ideas about how we can solve that problem? Because it's already a problem now.
I mean, I think that you would have to be able to provide more services within the community. I think that's one of the things that, and I'm talking about healthcare services. I think that that's what's made the difference. This healthcare center is a block away, I mean, five blocks away, where women can walk to. They don't have to worry about transportation. If they have an emergency with their child at night, they can. The clinic is open late so that they can work with them. They open till about 8, 9 o'clock at night. So I think having access, if you think about your community, when I lived in Brooklyn, I didn't want to go anywhere else to do anything else. People are really wedded to their communities. And even within their communities, you know, you'll hear, I'm a diehard Bed-Stuy person. I'm not going to Clinton Hills, or I love Harlem. I want to do all my resources in Harlem. So I think that the idea, and that's what New York City is doing, of having more clinics that are free within our community, I think is essential. And to be able to, for ex-offenders to be able to have access, because, you know, you have to really figure out how to change mindset. And so changing a mindset about traveling hours or changing mindsets about neighborhoods, it's much more difficult to do. So I think you have to bring some of the services to the community.
Also, one of the things that I found was that we have a great program called a Coming Home Program at St. Luke's Roosevelt. And one of the things that makes that program so good is that when the women or the men walk in there, they know that everybody that's in there working, other than the doctors and the nursing staff, has been incarcerated. So they don't feel prejudged. They don't feel ashamed to tell, like, the doctors their issues about what may have happened, what was their medical concern when they was in prison, or what they was getting treated for when they was in prison. So I think that would make a big difference also.
I think also New York City's health homes, I don't know if you've spoken about that or you're going to speak about that, but I think that program, it's not fully implemented everywhere, is going to be something that I would see that would be helpful, because you have care managers and care coordinators, and those coordinators who are calling those clients who don't have Medicaid or need to reduce Medicare use or whatever the purpose is. To be able to find those people, and some of them will be formerly incarcerated individuals, will be helpful, because the care coordinators and care managers are not just doing work around health issues. They will be helping to address some of the social needs. So I think that I love New York City for this. It's a headache in some ways for organizations, but I think the concept of health homes is a good one, where you're redesigning Medicaid so that it works for the individual. And I think that that's a step forward for New York to be able to do that.
No, I think these two ladies really covered it. I mean, in terms of thinking about redesign for primary care, I think certainly having a staff that is culturally competent to throw out lingo that's often used and probably used too often is a right first step. The Coming Home Program is one of our Transitions Clinic Network programs. It's just another example of program that in particular has made a committed to the vision and the mission of really caring for formerly incarcerated individuals and having those individuals employed as part of St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital. I think that this raises all sorts of other employment issues and issues of employment discrimination, but it's an important one that healthcare centers can take on. The second, and I think this is, you know, in along the side of thinking about how clinics ought to reach in and be tied to communities, having community health workers, you know, that concept originates in a really kind of politically activated way of thinking about the social determinants as the primary drivers of health and healthcare utilization. That if we're really going to make a dent on the health of our communities, that it's really thinking about homelessness, employment, their families first, as opposed to how often they get to their primary care doctor and how we can reduce emergency department visits. And I think that having community health workers that have that broader vision of thinking about the whole person, the whole patient, is that link. And having that person be former prisoners, is a good step in the right direction. It's not that I meant to be grim about the Affordable Care Act. I think, again, it holds tremendous promise. It's more that is exactly as you said, the devil is in the details, and really thinking about insurance is a first, it's a necessary, but it's not a sufficient step to getting individuals engaged in healthcare.
Can I just ask a question? Dr. Wong, I'm curious as to the locations and the sort of idiosyncrasies or peculiarities of your clinics, how they're different, and the populations that you serve. If you could give us a sampling, that would be great.
So that's a great question. Part of, I think, the creation of this network is that it's really organically created. I think it takes a special sort of clinic, a special sort of physician environment to actually embrace the real, I think it's it's a reality, but many clinics don't own that reality, that they're already seeing former prisoners and they want to design specific programs targeting that. And so our programs I can name a few on the East Coast to start, New York, the Coming Home Program, Montefiore in the Bronx, Rochester, New York, Birmingham, New Haven, Baltimore, Maryland. So you can see that these are all spaces where the rates of incarceration are high, and they also had either clinic or physician champions. Richmond, California, San Francisco, California, the Navajo Nation, Caguas, Puerto Rico. We've had, and then there's others, Georgia, Atlanta. I mean, there's Atlanta, Georgia. There's a number of other clinics that are in our broader network. Each of these each of these clinics have reached out to us, recognizing that they, in their community health center, are already seeing individuals with a history of incarceration and are trying to better serve the population that these community health centers target. The real, I think, strength of it, of our network, are the idiosyncrasies. It is really different to think about how you provide services to an individual that's returning home to the Navajo Nation compared to an individual that's returning home to New Haven or to San Francisco. The resources are different, the criminal justice milieu is different, and the community health centers are different. So, you know, to your question about the mental health and the substance abuse services, it's really different. Even how Medicaid's funded, as you probably know, is really different in every state. So while here in New York, maybe the Medicaid services for substance abuse and mental health, there aren't barriers, there are significant ones in Connecticut. There are even larger ones in the Navajo Nation. So I think that the richness of our network, and, you know, I'm speaking for kind of a real host of community health workers and physicians that all take part in this, are those idiosyncrasies that we've tried to design a model that really, with those four elements, can be scaled up in any setting, any community health center. But that said, how that looks and how that plays out, even hiring of former prisoners in community health centers, is really varied. And we're really committed to both studying it and improving it as we move forward, recognizing that it's not necessarily going to be a one-size-fits-all.
I'm Nora from Wisconsin State University of Journalism. You're the first person that's mentioned that transition for American people, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that's taken, what that looks like, what you've seen.
Sure. Well, I'm no expert on this, so if I'm the only person in the room that's talked about it, then I'm happy to share what I do know, but there definitely are experts on that. So one of the things that I have seen first off is, number one, there aren't numbers on it. We've been working with the Bureau of Justice Statistics trying to categorize just how many individuals return home to the Navajo Nation or identify as Native. There are no numbers. The second is that it's a really different experience, such that, and maybe some of you guys know this in the room, I'm definitely, again, not the expert on this, but if you commit a misdemeanor crime, it's adjudicated in front of the jails, in the Indian jails. If you commit a felony on the Navajo reservation, then it's adjudicated with the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney General's office. If you commit a felony and you're a Navajo and you've committed off the reservation, then you are in, you know, the four different states that surround the reservation, right? And the Exactly. And in fact, most is what, when we visited, that's what they're saying, is that most are prosecuted by the state. So what this means for the person returning home, because that's where we spend our time thinking about it, is that for those that have been convicted of a felony on the reservation, they're assumed to be sex offenders, and it's so stigmatized because those are the only crimes that get prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney General's office. This is from them. I, you know, again, I'm not an expert on this, but from the experience talking to the patients there, that it's a more stigmatized experience than even having HIV on the reservation. So then designing a clinic or having healthcare services that are really targeting their needs is even more difficult, if you can imagine, than, say, in New Haven. And so that's just a great example of, again, a space where we let the local leaders figure out what makes sense. And when I mean local leaders, I mean the Navajos that are living there, that run their health centers, of thinking about what makes the most sense with those kind of four principles that we have designed, which is having a former prisoner that's a community health worker. And they have a real robust network of community health workers. And so that piece of it isn't as difficult.
Can you say the four principles?
Oh, sure. It's early access to care. Having a community health worker with a former, who is a former prisoner, having physicians that are either have worked in the prison system or have been trained to know kind of the specific health risks of incarceration, and having really strong ties to social service agencies that attend to the more social determinants of people's health.
We're time for one, maybe two questions.
Emily, I'm wondering, you mentioned in your study that there was a 50% drop in emergency room visits over 12 months. Did your study look at all at recidivism rates?
We did. And again, we weren't necessarily focused on that outcome. But what we looked at, and again, in a room, I'm sure, of individuals that have better measures of criminal justice outcomes, we looked at re-arrest rates or time back in jail. We found no difference between the arms that were randomized to transitions or those that were in expedited care. It's about 50% had any re-arrest or time in the county jail in the 12 months after their enrollment. I will say that, you know, to that end, the re-arrest rates in San Francisco at that time were about 70%. So it's plausible that both arms showed a reduction. It's hard to say. The study wasn't designed to do that.
I guess back to the beginning. And for those that might be curious, too, I mean, we made the point about family reunification and we touched on it generally. For folks who are just a bit more curious about Mercedes' story, I guess if you Google Mercedes and Brooklyn Rail, you'll find a powerful story about her. I would definitely recommend folks reading it because it really captures the sense of what folks face. By way of, I guess, a final question, and I don't know if it may lead towards a grim assessment of sorts, but I sense as we sit here, though, that if I'm not incorrect on this, that about half the country has not opted into Medicaid in terms of expanding it to the poor. And I wonder, just by way of your expertise, if with this ticking clock going, if there's a sense that many folks will fall through the cracks as we look at it nationally in terms of expansion and having access to care. How can that happen in places like Virginia and others where, if they're not expanding it, folks aren't going to get the access?
Sure. I'm, again, not an expert on kind of Medicaid rollout or thinking about the Affordable Care Act, and there are those in the room that certainly are more knowledgeable of this. But historically, I mean, just looking at the rollout of Medicare, it's similarly fashioned, which is that certain states didn't opt in initially, and now look. Yeah. And so, again, it's not to close on a grim place. Affordable Care Act and the promise of insuring those that were previously uninsured. It's a remarkable step towards insuring those that are returning home from prison and jails. There's no doubt about that, none whatsoever. And I do think, like any huge national policy reform, there are going to be some setbacks, no doubt. But that said, I think both historically as well as hope evidence that many more individuals returning home from prison will be insured in the next few months to a year.
Great. So
I just want to make one final note because Mercedes talked about men being babied, and I'll say as the only male on the panel, the youngest of six brothers, that I know nothing about being babied. So I just want to make that point clear, but certainly to thank this wonderful panel as we go to wrap-up notes. Thank you.
Thank you, Curtis, as well. So we've asked, I hope our panelists can stay for lunch as well, because I know you all want to talk to them. We're going to have our lunch here, and it's coming in momentarily. I apologize for the alarms, what happens in university. Thank you all very much. We're going to have an hour for lunch, and then we're going to go back at work again. Thank you.
No.